Today we have a true legend in the world of RC aerobatics joining us, Andrew Jeske. From his humble beginnings flying at the age of 7 to becoming a household name in the RC community, Andrew has soared to remarkable heights of success. As a multiple-time US F3A national champion, Team F3A world champion, and Tucson Aerobatic Shootout champion, Andrew's trophy self speaks volumes about his mastery of the skies. And let's not forget his impressive second place finish in the F3A World Championships in Australia just last year, a testament to his skill and dedication. But Andrew's contributions don't stop there. Alongside his family, he runs AJ Aircraft, crafting high-quality RC planes that have earned a dedicated following within the RC community. Beyond his accomplishments, Andrew is renowned for his generosity, always eager to share his wealth of knowledge with fellow enthusiasts. In today's conversation, we delve into Andrew's recent experience at the 2023 F3A World Championships, uncovering the secrets behind his training regimen and meticulous setup of his aircraft. Plus, we get an exclusive peek into the latest innovations from AJ Aircraft and what's on the horizon for the company. Hey, Andrew. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, sir?
Great. Thanks for joining us. It's really cool to have you here.
No, definitely. I'm excited to be on. I know it's been a bit of a challenge to get this scheduled, but we had some downtime, can do this now.
Yeah, you're busy. I get it. So I was really excited talking to you, partly because I've been following you for like many, many years. You've always, I think the first time I probably saw you was when you were doing like Tucson Aerobatic Shootout freestyle.
And it was a long really time cool. ago.
Yeah, it's been a while. But it's been really cool seeing you, how you've still kicked ass, whether it's with your company, with F3A, with iMac. So partly just from my own sake, I was really excited about having you here. But also, you are probably one of the people that have been the most like requested guest. Like a lot of people wanna hear from you. I think a lot of people really respect you as a pilot, and they know that you've done a lot in the hobby and for the hobby. Excited to have you here.
That's awesome. I appreciate that, and definitely excited to get on here and hopefully answer some questions that people might have.
So maybe let's start from the beginning. How did you get started in RC?
So for me, it started off with the family. My brother and dad got involved about a year before I did. I was 6, and my brother had asked for a model airplane for Christmas. He was 13 at the time. So they actually, it was a Goldberg, the Mirage 550. So it was an old electric brushed airplane, and they built it over the winter, went out, flew it a couple times, you know, on NICADs, you know, really old technology. So again, it would have been like 94, I think. And they kind of learned that the electrics weren't really the way to go. And, you know, kind of were hooked with the glow airplanes. So they kind of progressed for a summer. And then the next year, we were still very involved in it. And a guy named Dave George in Michigan was at the Indian City Radio Control Club. We would have a fence, and all of the pilots could sit on the far side of the fence. All spectators were behind. So I was always behind the fence where my family was out in front. And he came up one day and just said, "Hey, you know, do you want to fly?" And I said, "Oh, of course." And he said, "You know, do you know your left and rights?" And I told him yes. And we kind of went over that. But one of the interesting things that I thought was very smart now looking back is he actually had me look at the radio when I first started flying, and he would just tell me right, left, up and down. And we did this for probably 5 or 10 flights. And what it did is it kind of instilled, just listen to his voice, because, you know, a lot of people, they get very scared when the airplane's heading towards the ground. Well, this kind of took that out of the equation, because it trained me to listen to his voice. And then if the airplane was going down, it was still the same voice, you know, pull up or, you know, push down left and right. And it was just kind of on from there. You know, we were very fortunate to live maybe 10 miles from the flying field. And we would, you know, we'd go out there a couple times a week and really just had a really great group of guys. That's one of the things that I love about being able to go to these fields is you really learn what the people are like and kind of, you know, incorporate almost into a family. And that's what we had out there. I remember, you know, work parties, being out there 7, 8 years old, helping, and, you know, riding around wheelbarrows with people pushing me and just having a lot of fun. And, you know, those are some of the memories that are kind of instilled in my brain. And I try and, you know, when I go out to the field and people are new and have those questions, you know, really take the time to help with those things, because somebody took the time out of their day, you know, maybe that they didn't really have, but they wanted to keep the industry going and the modeling world going. So that's one of the things that I really try and, you know, continue with.
Yeah, it's definitely hard as a beginner to the hobby. A lot of things can feel overwhelming, scary, can be expensive at the beginning, especially if you're like crashing or making mistakes on setup.
And thankfully, nowadays with the simulator, you know, that's one of the best tools to get people into it because, you know, it kind of takes just being able to hit spacebar or the red button on real flight to get going. That's one of the things that I've always told people is, you know, go get a simulator and kind of learn. You know, it's a inexpensive way to see if you really like it. And then, you know, one of the other things that once people come out that have done the simulators, I really try and push, you know, the club guys to not make it seem so scary for new people to come out. You know, there's been a couple of times I've been out the field and guys have been really adamant about, well, these are our safety rules. This is what you have to do. Like, we understand that they're the safety rules, but I think what the clubs need to make sure that they push is rule number one is to have fun. You know, that's why we're out doing it is because it's a hobby. We want to, you know, we spend hard earned money and time, go out, have fun. So that's one of the things that I always make sure to tell people that come in, you know, this is a fun hobby. It's done wonders for me. You know, it's turned into a career, not even from the AJ aircraft side, but from the UAV world that I'm doing now. So I mean, just have fun with it. That's the main focus for me.
Yep, makes sense. So I assume that most people probably know you from aerobatics, whether it's on the IMAX side, freestyle, or F3A. Were you always drawn to aerobatics in some capacity from the beginning when you started with RC?
I was. So how it kind of worked for me is another very good friend. And I think that's kind of the one thing that I'll point out. And, you know, in this is it always kind of revolves around one friend that was very interested in doing it. And he shared his time. So when I was about 9 years old, Bob Kane decided he was going to start flying pattern and kind of approached my dad and brother and said, "Hey, is this something you want to do?" And you know, I was drawn to it. You know, it was kind of cool. I got to travel, you know, being young. So it was actually Bob, his young daughter, and myself. We went to Florence, Kentucky, and flew in a pattern contest. And I love meeting the people and getting to see the new airplanes. So that, you know, that kind of continued through. But I think the reason that I've stuck with aerobatics as long as I have, especially the sequence stuff, is another good friend of mine, Vern Kester, he kind of came to me when I was a little bit older and said, there's no such thing as a perfect flight in pattern or an IMAC. He said, you have the criteria, you have the schedule that everybody flies, but there's nobody will ever fly 100%. And that's always stuck in my mind as striving to fly the best that I can. You know, and there's been times that, you know, I've had a flight that's, I feel 97%, you know, the conditions, my mind, everything was perfect. But again, there was still 3% left. And, you know, that drive is what makes me go to the flying field every time is to try and achieve that. So it's been something, and like I say, you know, I love watching the guys that fly freestyle and, you know, doing it before, but you don't know what they're going to do. So, you know, if there's a mess up, only they know. But in sequence work, you know, especially at the world championships, everybody's watching and everybody knows the criteria and the sequences. So that's where I feel like on the biggest stage for me, I it's really my motivator to keep going flying.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, in pattern, the playing field is pretty much the same for everybody, right? Like, it's very clear what you're supposed to do, and it's very hard to hide when you make a mistake. It's not like, I didn't want to do it at the beat of the music right there. It's okay.
Exactly. And you know, there's little differences. Like, some people fly slower. So I fly a little bit faster. And so there's still a little bit of style to it. But in the end, you know, that's kind of the critical thing with that no matter what, you're still trying to present the maneuver in a way that the judges, you know, give you the best score. So that was kind of that's kind of always been where I, you know, push for and do it. But again, it still gives you a little bit of style. And you can notice that the World Championships, you know, from all the competitors, you can kind of tell regionally how they fly, if they're in close, if they're out far, if they're a little faster, if they're a little slower. So I still enjoy that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. So I guess fast forward, you've now competed in how many World Championships of F3A?
I'm trying to think. So 7, 9, 11, 13, 15, 17, 19, 23. So it's been 8 worlds so far. So wow. I've been very, very fortunate.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
And that's so every 4 years?
It's every 2 years. So
every 2 years, okay.
Yeah. And in 2021, of course, we didn't do it because of COVID. But yeah, I've been very fortunate to be part since 07. Yeah, really had a lot of good teammates. Brett Whitkaiser, Jason Schulman, we've all been on the same team. Chip was on one of the teams in 11. AC was there in 17. And what's been kind of cool is now they've also integrated like juniors. So Joe Chazur, he started going in 13 with South Africa. So, you know, Cal in 2019 went to Italy. So that part's always just been really, really fun to do. And it's experience every time you get to go, you know, you get to explore a different country, different environment. It's been really, really good. And a lot of it is catch up with old friends. That's one of the best, you know, best things that I've come out of that is some of my friends from overseas, you know, Hamish Galloway from New Zealand. I talk to Hamish every single day, and that started from just a friendship in 2017. So it's been really, really cool.
Yeah, definitely it's a good excuse to get together with people that are kind of all over the world, too far to hang out with on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly. But what I find very interesting is no matter if you've not seen that person in 2 years, you can start a conversation and feel like you've just, you know, it was just yesterday that you talked to them. So that's mm-hmm. one of the really cool things about the model airplane world.
Yeah. Yeah, and having like a very clear common interest and you both might be in different countries, different languages. You both have been thinking about the same type of things for a long time, right?
Yeah, so, and no, I would agree. And that was one of the things, you know, that I've always told some people in stories is, you know, the Japanese, we go to the worlds and, you know, I don't speak Japanese and the Japanese English is very broken, but we still speak model airplanes. So you can still look mm-hmm. and use your hands and gestures and, you know, still hold conversations with people like that. So it's definitely something that's very cool.
To be at the peak of any sport, airplane related or not, I know there's, you know, there's some talent behind it and there's a lot of training and practice of dedication behind it. When you get to something like the F3A Worlds, I know everybody there is like a really good robotic pilot. Everybody there has put a ton of time on setup, on trimming, on just training flights. How has been your approach lately to in this case, last year for the F3A Worlds? How do you tackle that type of training and knowing that, you know, I'm sure that you're at the beginning of the year, you are aiming pretty high to get the best possible result. But that's the same as everybody else. So how are you approaching that to make sure that you make the most of it?
So, you know, everybody kind of has their own differences when it comes to practice. What I've always tried to do is just consistent practice. You know, I will start out in the beginning of the year just flying the preliminary sequences and really trying to get that kind of figured out. And the reason that I do that is at the Worlds, for example, we have the first 4 days, you only fly one flight a day and it's just the preliminary. So you get one shot for that day. So I focus on that as best I can. And then from there, I will start to mix in the final sequence, you know, basically going from, you know, in the beginning, if I go out and fly four flights a day, let's say, you know, it'll be four P's and then it'll go from three P's and one F and then it'll go two P's and two F's. And then when we start to get closer, I'll start to put unknowns in because we have an unknown catalog. And thankfully, we have some people that have created software to just generate it for us. So, you know, you go to the website, it auto-generates it for you and you go fly it. But I'm always working on P because that is what I like to consider my foundation. That when I go to a contest, I know that I have the confidence to fly it well. And for me, that's a lot of it is the confidence starting the sequence is flying P well, and then moving into F's and unknowns. You know, it's a little bit different nowadays with life, you know, working a little bit more and the family life. So if I can go out and get three flights in a day, I'm happy as long as they're consistently good flights. And that's what I always tell people is don't fly just to fly, like fly with a purpose, go out, practice with a purpose. And even if there's days that you don't feel like you're doing well, I actually will stop flying. Like if my head's not there, if I don't feel like I'm 100% focused, then I just won't go and practice because it's not beneficial to do that. But one of the things that people have seen and said about me is I fly a lot. And the reason for that is more, it's a comfort level. You know, when you get to a big contest, the nerves are there. But what I found is flying the way that I fly, when I take off, like I'm nervous up to the point where I plug my batteries in and my collar sets the airplane down. But once I take off, it's just another flight. You know, it's letting your mind go away and muscle memory takes over at that point. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I've always done that. You know, people see me out there when I'm getting ready for a flight, like I have my earbuds in and I'm listening to music, and that just kind of tunes out the outside world and kind of lets me get into my own little bit of a zone. And it's a routine thing. You know, everybody kind of has their own thing, but that's what has seemed to work for me. And I've been very comfortable with going about it that way. You know, and Hamish is actually the one that kind of told me about that practice routine, because he would just go out and fly two flights. He'd fly a P and he'd fly an F, just because he's a very busy individual. And he said, you know, hey, life's going to get busy for you. And he said, just really focus on two flights. And if I can get two, I'm happy. If I can get three, I'm happy. But continuously thinking about making the best flight possible. You know, and I think that's kind of the mindset you have to go into. Is, you know, it's not just a practice flight. Think of it as a contest flight. From the way I take off to the way I land is identical in practice or competition.
Did you, all the way through the year up to the Worlds, did you stick to that general routine of like prioritizing preliminary and then the bit of unknown, the bit of final?
Yeah. So again, same thing through the Worlds. Practice that way. And then when we actually got to Australia, you know, my first few days, like I just practiced P, and then I would start doing some Fs and unknowns. And then again, the way that the contest is structured, the first 4 days are P. So the last day of practice, I only fly P. Because like I can go and practice throughout the week. It's not like an IMAC contest where you can't fly during, you know, during it. So, you know, fly P, make sure that's all good, and then just go practice. And a lot of times at the Worlds during P, it's more just a comfort thing, because again, you're only flying one flight a day. So you have all of this time and you're like, well, what do I do with all this time?
Yeah.
And again, it's, you know, it's a routine, it's comfort. So I'll go out and practice. And then between, you know, if you're fortunate enough to make the semis, you have a day off. That's their rain day. And that's where they switch from prelims to finals. So you would go and then you would just start flying finals and you would fly unknowns, during that time, because it's, the way that they schedule, or the way that they have it, if it's over like 100 people, they take 30% of into the semis. So they would take 30 pilots, and then from 30 they cut it down to 10. So basically, once the semis are over, and if people kind of know where they end up with the scores that they give you, then you go out and you practice unknowns that night before you have the meeting for the unknowns where they're generated. But again, you know, a lot of it for me is just, it's the comfort. It's what I know, especially, you know, there's a lot of things, right? You're in a foreign country. Sometimes the food's different. Sometimes you're driving on the wrong side of the road. But when you're at a flying field and you're plugging your batteries in and flying your model airplane, that's the, you know, that's the comfort that you
you're
know.
Used
that's,
to it.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
So it's semifinals, using the final sequence and no unknowns.
Yeah. Semis is just the final sequence. So what they do is they make going into the semis, they take your four rounds from prelims and make a composite. So it's just a 1,000. So you can either take one of your P's and one of your F's or both of your F's to get you into the unknown, because they keep your best 2 out of 3. So for me, I normally always keep a P and I take an F, as we're like Jason Schulman, he focuses a lot on F. So he normally keeps both of his Fs, but you know, it all depends on who's there and where the contests are. It's kind of just what, you know, what you're used to practicing and how you practice it. But that to me is like a prime example of, you know, 180 out. Jason usually practices Fs and unknowns, and I practice a lot of P, Fs and unknowns. But again, you know, at the Worlds, we finished 2 and 3. So it shows that whatever you do and whatever is your comfort is kind of the critical thing.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think there has to be some strategy in there too, in terms of depending on how confident you are that you're gonna get into the semifinals or if you're gonna get into the finals or not. Like you can spend like hours and hours practicing unknowns, And it will improve you as a pilot. I wouldn't say it's useless, but unless you make it into the top 10, for the competition itself, it's not useful, right? And that time could have been better used on the P or the F sequence. So that's interesting.
It is. It's a very dynamic way, and we see that a lot in like the U.S. We have different people, and you try and kind of help them along, and you're like, you know, especially people that are flying a lot of P and are flying a lot of F and not a lot of P. I'm like, hey man, like you want to make sure that you're going to make it into the semis and then make sure into the finals. So it's a very big balance. And like I say, I can't say that there's any right way or wrong way. It's just whatever you feel is working. That's, again, the critical thing is, you know, making sure it works for that pilot.
Yeah. And yeah, as you said, I think last year, it seems like it worked out pretty well for you. You got second place, right, on the World Championships. You got first place in the team with Team USA, right, which is like awesome results. I know that I'm sure you would have done like first, but I know that every world's like the level is extremely high. And just getting to the final is something like very, very few people will ever do, even if they spend all of their life, winning their national competitions in their country. So it's a lot.
It was honestly incredible. Going to Australia for the first time and just meeting all of the people, you know, from the minute that we landed in Australia, everybody was just incredible. You're very comfortable. Again, you know, you're flying in an area that you've never been, but you know, we had Aaron Bones Garl and his family that kind of took us in and, you know, helped us along the way. And it was wonderful. Just the people in Australia were great, but yeah, you know, second was, that was the best that I've ever finished. It was really cool being on the podium with Jason, you know, myself and Jason up there. That's the first time that's happened is since Australia 91 when Chip and Davon Lindsay were first and third. So, you know, being able to share the podium with a team member, watching Lassie win, it was incredible. You know, he's an amazing pilot. He put the work in. Everybody puts the work in. But to see that type of environment and everybody flying really well, you know, I couldn't be more proud. You know, listening to, like you say, the national anthem for the team gold. We've been very fortunate to have been team gold since 2011. So we've won quite a few in a row, and you know, it's a testament to everybody that's on the team and how they practice, and you know, that everybody puts 100% effort into this contest, and it's really cool to see. And like you say, you know, you got friends from all over the world, and you know that they're trying as hard as they can. I spent a lot of time with the New Zealanders last year calling for them and kind of coaching, and that's the part that really drives it home for me is, you know, it's an individual sport, but in the end, you spend the time with all these people and help everybody because it helps grow F3A, which is what I want, you know, grow it and keep it going as long as possible.
Yeah, what's really cool too is that my impression is that in most of these competitions, even though you are technically competing with everybody else over there, for the most part, it seems like people are trying to help each other to get the best possible flight they can, right? You are not like, it's like the opposite of going there and like removing a servo to see if this guy has a problem in their flight. Like you're actually trying to help them with tips, with setup, with whatever you can. And you're just trying to do your best possible flight and then see where you end up.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things that I've always kind of told people is, you know, with our scoring program, it gives you like the percentage possible of your flight. And it's very hard in a competition because you always compare yourself against who's winning the round. But what I always tell people to focus on that percentage, right? If 100% is going to be a perfect flight, that's tens on everything. But, you know, really try and up that score. You know, I've seen people that have been in the 80% or, you know, the low 80s, and they're like, oh, I think this sequence is too easy. And I'm like, if you're getting 8.5s or, you know, between 8s and 9s, like it's, you can do better. You can get, you know, between 9s and 10s. And if you start to look at it in that element, then you really start to figure out, you know, it's that you fly against yourself. Yes, it's you're flying against somebody else, but they're doing the same thing, right? They're trying to put in the best possible flight. So rather than focus on somebody else's flight, you focus on your own. You'll find your flying exponentially gets better.
When there's so many really good pilots there with so many hours of training behind, with probably really good planes with really well, you know, really well set up for this type of sequences, I could imagine that the top 10, top 20 flights end up looking extremely similar. Do you ever feel like It's hard for the judges to actually, like, you know, get to a point where, like, the actual final order is, like, really what you would expect based on the quality of the flights, or the flights are so close that
there's a little bit of there's a little bit of style that kind of is involved with the flying. And I would say, though, that most of the worlds that we've been to, the order is correct. Yeah, you can have a few different places here or there, and again, it's a lot of opinion. But one of the big things actually that kind of drives it is the flight order. That's one of the things that we've tried to figure out how to make it, because a judge, the first pilot, even if he flies an almost perfect flight, it's very hard for the judge to give the scores, because he doesn't know what the next 9 pilots are going to do, especially in an unknown. I think in a final sequence where the judges have been there and seen it already this week, they have a baseline, but in an unknown, there's no baseline. And that first pilot kind of sets it. And I can say that I've been in that position the last 2 worlds. My second flight in the unknowns, I've been first up in 2017 and 2019. And you can fly as well as you hope to, and you're not going to get the scores. But again, that's part of the luck. To win one of these competitions, you have to have, the right equipment. You have to have the right practicing. You have to have luck on your side. And I've always said, that's one of the critical things about it. And having been on both sides of it, it's never good when it happens to you. Unfortunately, Gurneau had it happen this year. He flew, he won the first unknown, and I think he was second in the final sequence. But the third unknown, he was up last, or he was up first, and he wasn't going to get the scores. So it's unfortunate that's kind of part of how the competitions go. But if you've been in it long enough, I would say that you've probably reaped the benefits of it, and you've also experienced, the bad side of it. But again, that's where it goes back to. If you feel like you cannot fly any better than what you've done, scores are they're going to be what they're going to be, and you just kind of go with it.
I also imagine that on the semifinals, with the final sequence, and especially in the finals when you add the unknowns, you start seeing a bit bigger differences between flights, right, and between pilots. I'm sorry that not everybody has the final sequence nailed the same, or especially the unknowns. I know that unknowns in IMAC, that's where you start seeing like big differences between different flights.
Yeah, you definitely do that. But what I would say is, most of the guys at the world, especially the top 10 guys, everybody's flown all of the figures in the unknowns. They might not have flown them in that order, so their airplanes have been set up for that. So yeah, it's a difficult thing, but that's one of the things I really like about F3A is we have the unknowns. We have the maneuvers that we're going to fly. We have the catalog of them. So you can put them in whatever order you want. So you're trimming your airplane out for that. A lot of times in IMAC, like I've struggled with practicing unknowns because I'll just take something that's been generated, from Tucson's, prior Tucson's, but they always seem to throw something different and that I wasn't expecting. Maybe the airplane's not exactly set up for that. So it's difficult to fully get the unknowns exactly where you want them. But I would say the top 10 at the worlds, they're flying unknowns that look really, really good. But again, there is separation, whether it's airplane dependent or, because again, in F3A, everybody can fly whatever they want as long as it's in a 2-meter by 2-meter box. You can monoplanes, triplanes, biplanes, contra, non-contra. So there's a lot of things in that regard. And again, it comes down to the judging side, like we had talked about, whether they like them fast, whether they like a little bit slower. And I think as a pilot, like that's one of the things that I've kind of really tried to hone in on, right? So I started flying, I've always flown a little bit faster, but now I'm trying to slow it down. I started flying contra last year at the Worlds, still a little bit faster than most, but it fit my style. And now I'm trying to develop my style and make it a little more fluid, or what the other guys are flying as well. So, it's a constant journey. It's a constant battle, and it changes with the sequences. Every 2 years, something comes out and you have to start relearning it and refiguring out. But again, that's part of the drive that I really like in the F3A world.
Can you talk about the model you used on the setup?
So I flew a Huyang F3A it's called the Proteus WC, and a lot of it actually stemmed from the CA models Proteus that I did with Marcelo Colombo. And I guess even before then, you know, with the AJ aircraft, the way that I did it is I designed a 110 size version, and it kind of got the things that I wanted, the wing placement, the incidences that I want. And then I went to Marcelo and we had it drawn. And I flew that airplane from 2020 through 2023. I flew it there. And then at the Worlds, I switched to Yang. And basically what I had done is I said, okay, Yang, like, I want to go into the Worlds with the best equipment possible, with everything that I can. You, in my opinion, make the nicest models, that are available. And I already had the 3D drawings done. Alexander Safarik over in Washington did them for me. And basically he had to just cut the molds, and produce them. And then, it was just a really nice thing. I changed up a new color scheme. I had Steve Johnson do the color scheme. And then as far as the equipment inside of it, Andreas from, I will butcher his last name, but I think it's Pateroni. He designs a very nice Contra from Argentina that I have used a lot and really enjoyed it. So I put that in there. Again, you know, kind of what we had talked about with the speed. So most people run 23-inch Contra props, and I actually was running 21-inch Contra props with the same pitch, 20 inches of pitch. And what we had heard is in Australia, it was going to be very windy. So by using the smaller props, I could cut through the wind a little bit better. Actually turned out that it wasn't very windy at all in Australia, but it's okay. You know, I practice with it that way. Jetty ESC, one of the Maison 80 Pros, Vitaba BLS 173s on elevators and ailerons, and the rudder had a 171. Everything was running S-Bus, and you know, I think I had talked about it before, but what's so nice about this Worlds is, like, I plugged everything in every single flight, whether it was practice or the contest, and never once worried about my equipment. You know, that right there, the peace of mind that you get to be able to do that when you go up and just focus on the flight and not have to worry about your equipment is so critical, because again, it's that comfort level. You're comfortable just using it. You know it. I mean, I would say that I practiced probably 300 flights before the World Championships, you know? So, I mean, there was quite a bit, and that was just that year. The year before, you know, it was probably between 300 and 400 for the US, you know, nationals. But again, when you know that everything's just going to work, you know, again, I didn't talk about the batteries, but Thunder Power batteries, same thing, right? Just plug them in. You never have to worry about them. It's just that the evolution of electrics has come so far, even in a shorter amount of time. You know, when they first started, my first F3A pattern plane that was electric was in 2005, I do believe. You know, and just to see exponentially how things have gotten better, motors, ESCs, propellers, batteries, everything has just gotten so much better. And again, you know, when you plug a battery in, you turn your radio on and you just go fly. Like, you never worry about what, you know, what could be. And that's why I chose those components. And I know that there's a lot of other components that are out there that work just as well. But for me, it was, you know, I always laugh about, like, the Contras. You know, the Contra is very simple. It's a belt and it's a pinion gear, kind of like a helicopter. But I can see it, I can look at it, I can touch it, I can feel it, and I can make sure that it's going to work. As were some of them where they're, you know, encompassed and, you know, the drive is inside of something else and I can't see it. That right there in my mind makes me worry, like, well, what's happening on the inside where I can't see that? So that, you know, those are kind of the reasons why I kind of choose that route. You know, the even down to, like, the motor. So I run the EcoDrift motors, and having special wounds, you know, wines made for that with my smaller props. I run a higher KV, and Vincent was like, yeah, no problem. Like, we'll make whatever you want. And, you know, that's what people don't get, you know, in the industry. You know, 10 years ago, you didn't get that. You got, here's the motor you run, here's the prop that you run, here's the battery, and that's it. You know, now we have all of these variables, and it makes it so nice, especially, you know, even just demographically, like, you know, people down in South America, you know, they can get really good models from Marcelo at CA Models, Andreas's Contras, you know, all of it are kind of made down there. People in Europe, they can get, you know, the Advarons, which are made over in Europe, you know, models that are over there. That's the really cool thing that I like about F3A is, depending where you're at, you know, you have the ability to get all of those components.
when looking at the top, I don't know, 20 pilots at the World Championship like that, are the main characteristics of their planes and their equipment more or less well figured out, or do people use different things? Like, for example, this Proteus WC that you use, that's a biplane, right? Are most people using biplanes? Is there a mix on monoplanes and biplanes?
There's been a big switch over to biplanes. And the reason that is as our unknowns have gotten harder, you know, what they've done is they've added a lot of knife edge components to it. So everything, you know, integrated rolls and knife edge. So that's where the biplane kind of excels. Kristoff was flying a monoplane at the World Championships along with his son. You know, his son made the semifinals and won the World Champion in the Junior World Championships. Kristoff made the finals flying a monoplane, but mostly everybody else was flying biplanes. And I think what happens is it's kind of a comfort level. I think a monoplane you can fly a little bit easier when the sequences aren't as complex. But when the sequences get more complex with harder rudder, they become a little bit harder to fly. And that's kind of what I've found. I started flying a biplane at the Worlds in 2019. I flew it. I actually flew an old Accuracy from Naruki Design. And again, it was that balance of, okay, maybe it's a little bit harder to fly a P or make it, you know, look as straight as a monoplane. But when I got into the F and unknown maneuvers, it became easier and less work as a pilot. Because again, those unknowns, you're so task saturated with, you know, the high rate rudders. How many times are you flying into high rate rudder versus, you know, trying to make a monoplane do the same thing? It was just a little bit easier. And I think, you know, if the sequences ever go back to stuff that doesn't have as much knife edge, you will probably see a trend back to monoplanes. But I don't know that that's ever going to happen or won't happen for a while. That's kind of been the trend. And they're picking a lot of that up from the F3P Worlds. Like, you see a lot of the F3P figures now have a lot of rudder, you know, integrated rolling things, a lot of knife edge figure eights. And that's what we're doing now in F3A.
That's really interesting. Like, in IMAG, I kind of think when was the last time I saw a biplane flying an IMAG sequence. I guess there's not like a full scale design that is like particularly good for precision aerobatics, and that's probably part of it.
There is. It was funny. I actually was planning to go to Tucson last time with a biplane.
Really?
I have an Ultimate 20-300 that was designed down in Argentina. You know, it's very similar to the Aeroworks Ultimate, but it's a kit version that was made very light, and it works very, very well. I just ran out of time, you know, trying to get it set up, and thankfully Kevin and Al loaned me their MX2 that Toonie built, and it just worked, right? If I had the time, I probably would have flown the Ultimate, because there's a couple things that it does well. But again, you know, in the IMAC world, you have to keep it scale. I'll call it scale-ish. You know, it's not like the TOC where it was the 10% rule. But the Ultimate, for instance, you know, the top wing, if it's too tall, it induces a lot of roll coupling. So you start to, you know, when you get into where the biplane's beneficial for the knife edge figures, with that, where you can't change the things as much, you start to induce more roll coupling. So you actually make it harder on yourself to fly a biplane. But again, as a biplane, you know, it has a longer fuselage than a wing. So it's going to fly more like an arrow. So it's going to roll better. It's going to snap better. But again, it's harder to get those things, you know, kind of figured out. You know, Chip did it in 2002 at the TOC. You know, one of the things that they say that the Ultimates are really good at is tail slides. Again, same reason, you know, it's a longer fuselage than a wing. But so that airplane's still out in Utah, you know, depending what happens and how practice goes, you know, we'll maybe try and get that ready for Tucson this year. But more than likely, it's going to be a monoplane that that Alex and myself at Cam Aero have come up with. So I'm excited about that one.
Cool. Yeah, definitely will be interesting to see more vibes in IMAG, just for something different.
I tell you what, though, they, as much as a monoplane is to put together at the field, the biplane's even worse, because the only way to make it light is to have a single piece wing. So now you have this 100-inch long wing, you know, two of them, and trying to attach it, it's a bit of a struggle. But some of the benefits are there. So, you know, kind of working towards those things, but But yeah, you know, I think one of the big things that the reason is in iMac, there's not a lot of integrated maneuvers. You know, that like the most thing that you're going to see is maybe 3 of 4 at the bottom of a loop or an 8-point at the bottom of the loop. And these monoplanes, you know, again, it's an evolution. I think we've seen it from, so I flew the Godfrey in up to 2015. But what I was noticing is, you know, iMac started having these figure 6s, figure 9s that had integrated at the bottom of the loop. And those, the fuselage was just too small. So you'd get to the bottom, you'd really be digging in the rudder. But then, you know, Jason, Kevin, and Al came out that MX2, which is a little bit taller, a little bit bigger, and it just made it a little bit easier to do some of the integrated rolling figures at the bottom.
Hmm. All right.
So,
what about the...
Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to ask you about the Contra drive. You mentioned before you've been using Contra. Mm-hmm. Is that also a pretty... kind of set up for most people at that highest level in F3A, or people still using sometimes Contra, sometimes not?
No, I think most of everybody's now flying Contra. You know, there's a couple benefits from it. One of the biggest benefits that most people already know is downline braking. So it slows your downlines down quite a bit over a single prop. In an F3A, they actually changed the judging criteria to have constant speed as a judging criteria. Before, it used to not be that. You know, it's precision, smoothness, gracefulness, geometry. Now, smoothness and gracefulness have gone way to constant speed. You know, that's one of the things. But what actually the benefit that I found of it is in F3A about, I think it's almost been 10 years ago, they changed the unknown. So any roll reversal, and unknowns and knowns, but any roll reversal has to be immediate. So like when you roll, like even if it's just 2 half rolls reverse, before you could roll to invert it and hold it and then roll the other way. Well, now it has, the wings have to bounce off each other. And in an airplane with a single prop, your airplane actually, I'm trying to, you know, visually see if people can see it. Your airplane flies canted, right? It flies this way because mm-hmm. of the thrust. Well, when you roll it upside down, the airplane actually then goes this way. So in these rolling maneuvers, you can see the tail kind of do this. And, you know, that right there, even if it's a half a point to a judge, because they see the tail kind of coning rather than staying axial, is critical. And that was one of the main reasons why I went to Contra. When Contra first came out, you know, Saba had done it back in, gosh, like 2007, I think he had one in Argentina, my first Worlds in Argentina that I was at. He might have even flown it before then. But the airplanes weren't designed for it, right? Because, again, when we talk about that airplane flying at a little bit of an angle, well, you're getting stability because your fin is kind of – it's kind of like drag, right? But now with an mm-hmm. airplane that flies straight, you don't have that stability. So airplanes weren't designed with a big enough fin or tail. So you would see a lot of Contras early on, they would kind of hunt back and forth because they didn't have directional stability. Well, now that's kind of been changed. And I always tell people that are kind of getting into it, I say, look at, if you Google, you know, Google images, F3A planes from like 2010 and look at the tail volume versus the canopy, and now start to look at them, you know, in say 2019, 2020, you've seen the tails have gotten substantially bigger because people have found out those issues that are there. Myself included, you know, there's a lot of differences that happen once you start putting the two props on, but the benefits really outweigh it. And the biggest thing that we had before with why I didn't run Contra prior to, I actually flew Contra in 2017. But they just weren't as efficient. You know, the motors weren't as efficient. You were very close to batteries and weights. As batteries have gotten lighter, that technology, now I can run a heavier battery that maybe it weighed the same as what a 5,000 did before. So now, you know, battery consumption isn't on my mind as where before it used to always be on my mind. So, you know, that was because in our unknowns now, we don't get to drop any rounds. So if you zero maneuver or you don't finish the maneuver, you have to take that flight. And, you know, that's critical at one of these big competitions.
That's very interesting. I never thought, I always know, you know, Contra helping downlines slow down the plane. Yeah. I didn't know there was more to it. That's very interesting. Does it change the way you fly in terms of, like, you know, when you're going downline, do you go all the way to either, or do you actually have enough braking that you actually keep a bit of throttle to keep the speed consistent sometimes?
So So there's been some changes in the ESC world. So I still run a jetty, so it's very similar. So the braking doesn't come on until like the prop essentially would be stopped. So like if there was mm-hmm. no trim, that's when the braking activates. But I run an idle, so the braking isn't always on my model. I have it on a momentary switch. So what I have found is like on 45 degree downlines, I don't use any braking. I just let the braking of the props, the inherent drag that does that. And then on long vertical downlines is when I turn the braking on. But again, that's part of what I say where you're learning the new sequences. You know, there's times where, okay, I'll use the brake in here and I won't. For some 45s, you might want to use it if it's like a downwind 45 coming close to center and you have a early center box maneuver. That's when I'll turn the brake on. Again, you know, we're learning a new sequence this year. So I've kind of been working with that and AC. There's also been kind of a cool new, you know, it's been out for a little bit now, but Flight Coach. I don't know if you've seen mm-hmm. any of that.
You can basically plot your sequence.
Yeah, you can plot your sequence, but also plot your vertical velocity. So if you're mm-hmm. if you want to see how fast you're going vertical versus how fast you're coming down, because that's one of the things that I've always told people is, you know, they say constant speed. Well, they think of just going down slow. But if you're flying a fast horizontal and a fast vertical, that means your downlines have to be as fast as well. You mm-hmm. know, we actually kind of had this discussion a while ago because there was a gentleman who flew in 2011 who was very slow on the horizontals, but he would pull vertical and basically he was a rocket ship going up. And I said, well, that's not mm-hmm. really consistent speed. So, you try and tell people like, okay, consistent is uplines, downlines, and horizontals. But the flight coach has worked really well for seeing geometry, you know, making sure loops are round, making sure your entrance and your exit altitudes are the same, because a lot of the maneuvers now they start at the top and end at the top. You know, it's very easy to set your baseline down low, but when you're up at the top of it, it's a bit harder.
You don't have such a good reference. Yeah. You're a bit too far from the ground.
Yep. Exactly. So, you know, and a lot of people, they have a harder time seeing the geometry of the maneuver because there's a lot of elements. So it kind of allows you to go back. And one of the things AC and myself, what we've done is take our iPad out to the field and look at it right after the flight. And kind of what I try and tell AC to do and myself is I want to look at the flight and think about, okay, what did I do that I'm not sure of? You know, maybe this line didn't look like a 45. Visually think about it before I actually look at Flight Coach to see. That way I can start to visually see, okay, yep, this was what I thought or what it wasn't. So that it's been a very beneficial tool.
Yeah, it almost helps you train your eyes a little bit and how you think of the maneuvers.
Yeah. Yep, yeah, because a lot of times people don't realize, like, when you start flying, when you fly at, you know, in F3A, it's 150 meters to 175 meters. But a lot of times people fly arcs, including myself, because you know, what you think looks like 150 meters in front of you actually looks way different out at the edge of the box because, you know, the angle that you're flying. So it actually looks like you're mm-hmm. you're flying outbound, but you're really not. So, you know, training mm-hmm. your brain. But we also had this the same discussion is judges are still judging us. So until we move over to like a fully autonomous judge where you just plug in, you know, your flight coach, you have to do the benefits. You have to look at, okay, the judges are judging me. So maybe you kind of go that happy medium. You bend in a little bit, but not as much as you would before because some judges are you know, they're starting to use Flight Coach and look at that same thing. So yeah. it's a balancing act for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting because on paper, you should just do it perfect, however Flight Coach tells you.
Yep.
But the reality is that you are being judged by somebody that is not perfect. And their perception might not be correct, but that's what they're going to do, what they're going to use to judge your flight, right?
Exactly. So that's, you know, one of those things that you have to think about. You know, that's one of the things that you tell people. Think about that when you're going into competition, because if people say, well, this is how Flight Coach says it needs to be, until Flight Coach is actually a judge, then maybe, you know, you kind of have to massage the way that you do it just to make sure you still, you know, the judges see it how you want it as well.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see that move in the future, going towards like an automated?
I'm kind of up in the air. You know, I think one of the things that keeps people, you know, kind of involved is the judging aspect. And, you know, it's like that moving target. You never really know. But I think Flight Coach is good. But one of the things that I think would have to happen is you would have to almost integrate it as having them as just one judge, you know, at first, you know, mm-hmm. to have a panel and that would be one and see how it goes. Because again, you never know what it's going to be like. You know, I've had times where flight coach kind of jumps offline, or, you know, it has a little hitch in there. So you have to be able to make sure you have it backed up. But I think right now it's a very good training tool, especially for people that don't practice together, don't practice with other folks. Because you can share that, you know, that VIN file to anybody and say, hey, this is what I'm doing. You know, is there something that you think I should do differently? So again, I think it's a very beneficial training tool. And, you know, I applaud the people that have created it, because, you know, the ability to see what you're doing, you know, we've been flying F3A for so long that you just kind of, oh, I think this is a 45. Well, now you truly know if your airplane's flying a 45, and, you know, those things are very beneficial.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. Can you talk a bit about how you like to set up your F3A planes in terms of like flight mode switches? I know that this probably will depend maybe if, you know, next year there's a new sequence and has different elements. But generally, what's the general mindset that you take towards the setup for your planes?
So I do kind of the same setup, and what I end up doing is tweaking the rates if the sequence has changed. So I have a spin condition on one switch. So, you know, it's more elevator, more rudder, a little less aileron. But again, I have to make sure that I can do all spins. So in our unknowns, we have, you know, two spins opposite. So you need to make it fast enough so the transition, it doesn't throw the airplane way offline. But, you know, your normal 2.5 turn spin isn't too fast. So I have that. I have three rates on rudder. So I fly a low rate, which is my normal flight condition. I have like a knife edge, which is about 75% rudder. And then I have a 100% rudder for stall turns. You know, our airplanes actually will do rolling circles on low rates. So again, I use that knife edge just for, you know, knife edge square loops, knife edge loops, those types of things. And then the other thing I have is a snap condition. I actually have two snap conditions. I do mine a little bit different. So I base mine off a stick switch, but I still have to flip a switch. And I only use it off the aileron. So at 95% of my aileron, it will go into the snap condition or the snap rates. But again, I said I have two of them. So I have a horizontal snap and downline snap. And then I have one for uplines, because it's a little bit, you know, the uplines tend to be a little bit slower because gravity is kind of holding you down. But honestly, what that does is it actually, in my opinion, equals them out timing wise. So your upline snaps feel like your horizontal snaps just because of, you know, the reduced aileron that you have in there. But it's a very simple setup. And again, like I say, it changes, you know, year to year. The elevator throws, your rudder throws, your aileron throws change per the sequence. But that's my base consistent setup. And then the only other thing that I have, like we had talked about, is my momentary switch for my brake. And all it is, it's an idle down. And what I really liked about the Jetty ESCs is, like, if my throttle's at idle and I flip the brake switch, and a lot of people that have seen me fly, they're like, man, you flip a lot of switches. Well, I literally just pull the momentary switch and let it off. And what that does is it keeps the brake on until I hit the throttle again. Once I crack the throttle, then the brake comes off. So it just gives me the flexibility to, you know, to kind of use, you know, everything to my advantage. One of the things I know a lot of people are using D3s now, which that's the kind of the governor type ESC where you don't always come back to idle. I've just never been comfortable using that because, again, you never come to idle, so your downline mix is never fully engaged. So, like, you on a 45, you're 45 or even a full downline, if you're not at idle, the airplane's going to gradually pitch out to the canopy. So when you roll, the airplane actually has a little bit of a roll to it. So again, comes down to what everybody kind of enjoys, what they figured out. And that's just kind of been my standard setup that I've used for such a long time.
Switching gears, you've been running, I think it's you and your family, right? Running AJ aircraft for a while now.
Yep.
Can you talk about how that got started?
Yeah. You know, I always get a little bit reminiscent when it comes to this. You know, I look back at kind of how the designing stuff started. So in about 2004, I actually was a sponsor pilot with Flytown Aircraft, which, you know, people that haven't been around for a long time, they're not going to recognize that name, but they made some really cool, innovative electric airplanes. And they had sent a couple airplanes over. One was like an Edge 540 and one was an Extra, and they flew good, but I'm like, man, I think we can make these fly better. And they were like, you think so? And I was like, yeah, you know, this is what I tried. And they said, well, can you maybe think of something and you know, let us know. And And actually, so that's when I drew up my first ever airplane. It was an extra 330S. And everything was actually drawn on computer paper, hand-drawn airfoils, to scale. And I sent it over to him, and we were actually out in Arizona. Edson Hong was the guy's name. He was the U.S. importer, and he drove over from L.A. to Arizona to bring my first model. And it was just cool to see, right? It was the first time that I had turned something from paper into an actual model. And they flew well. AC is going to give me a bunch of crap because he always says that the first Ector wasn't that good. But he was young, and I don't think he knew what he was doing. So we actually still have one. But then it kind of evolved, right? So we did that, and then Flyton kind of went away, and Ben Fisher had started a 3D hobby shop. And I had a really good friend, unfortunately, he's passed away, Tim Tork, who kind of introduced me to Ben. And, you know, we had kind of talked about doing an airplane, what we wanted to do. Well, around that time, the Slick had just kind of not really been released, but a few people knew about it. And that was an airplane that was made over in South Africa. Glendale was the designer, and they actually kind of they basically took the extra type, layup with full composite. And then, but they were doing that in South Africa, and I had kind of gotten word of it. And what was kind of cool is the Slicks, there's a Slick 360 and there's a Slick 540, and they looked a little bit different. So I decided to go with the Slick 540. So that was the first one that we designed with AJ Aircraft, or with 3D Hobby Shop. It was a 51 inch. And that evolved, you know, up from a 42 inch version to 126 inch version. And, you know, people always think, oh, you know, is there any heartburn or any heartbreak with, you know, leaving 3D Hobby Shop? And there never was. You know, I'm super appreciative to Ben because he kind of gave me the platform to, you know, design models how I wanted to and kind of put my name out there. But like anything else, you know, you do something long enough and you want to say you get good at it, but you become more efficient. You know, you kind of want to do it on your own. And thankfully I had a really good friend here in Michigan who was like, hey, you know, you've worked really hard at doing this. You know, have you ever thought about, you know, kind of branching out and doing it yourself? And I said, yeah, I have, but there's a lot of logistical things that just didn't make sense at the time. Well, in 2008, my dad, was medically retired. So he was no longer working. And then my mom retired. So everything just kind of aligned. So in 2013, we designed a couple of the first airplanes and brought them over here. And we said, okay, we're going to go full steam. And we ordered our first container in 2014. And actually, it was kind of funny. I was thinking back. We turned pre-orders on at the Nationals in 2014. So my email blew up while we were at the Nationals. You know, something that I didn't need stress-wise. And from there, you know, it kind of turned into, you know, at first, the first container shared between my parents' basement and my brother's basement. But after the first container, what happened was we just realized that wasn't going to work. We got a warehouse. And it just has, it's kind of evolved. You know, it's still a very family-oriented business. My mom and dad run the day-to-day operations. My dad, you know, he mans the phones. My mom does a lot of the shipping stuff. My dad does the XPO-type shipping. But we have a lot of friends that come over and help us. You know, they kind of make a party out of it when a container comes over. It's a pizza party. And it's just been really, really cool to see the evolution, you know, even from my family side of the evolution, but even the model airplanes, you know, they were plywood and balsa before. And, you know, then it's like, okay, we're going to get into this type of composite, you know, structure. Now it's quick release. And the evolution of ARFs. I mean, you know, we always used to say that the ARFs have gone huge from, let's say, you know, 2000 to 2010. I think they've taken just as big of a leap from 2010 to 2020, you know, and beyond. You know, you got guys, you know, Ben Fisher and Tim Hanstein that are pushing the envelope with the things that they're designing in their factory. And we're trying to do the same with our factory. You know, in the end, what I think happens is it just makes the hobby that much better of a place. Because, you know, before, let's call it early 2000s, if you were in, you didn't really know what kind of airplane you were going to get. Was it a good design? Was it a quality build? Unless it was from like a company that you knew. But now you can order up from any company, whether it's Pilot, Extreme Flight, AJ Aircraft, Skywing, and they're all going to be good. You know, I've recommended to people, you know, that they're like, well, what airplane do you think? And I'm like, man, pick the one that you think looks the best. And if you have a dealer that's close to you, support them, because in the end, like, that's that's what you're going to draw to, right? If you can go pick up an airplane, you can go pick up spare parts, and you like the way it looks, you're not going to find a bad airplane.
It's hard to go wrong with any of those.
It really is. You know, and I would say at the same token, a lot of it is because, like, you know, people kind of pick up their, they have their airfoils that they've found that work, like myself. Like, I really haven't changed much in the way of airfoils except for our new airplane. So they all kind of fly the same in that regard, whether you change the wing area a little bit, you change the fuse length a little bit. But you know, I think before then people were kind of experimenting and trying new things, but now everybody kind of has their staple of what works. And that's where we go back to, you know, airplanes just don't fly bad. You know, you might have one that's going to do something a little bit better, whether it's a shorter tail moment airplane or a longer tail moment airplane. And that's, and I'm very honest to people when I talk about the designs that we have. You know, longer tail moment, it's going to fly really good. It's going to fly really straight. It's not going to tumble as good as something that's a little bit shorter. So, you know, those are the things that people kind of understand and see. And, you know, it's just been really, really cool to see the industry. And again, it's like we talked about with the F3A, meeting the people. You know, you go to some field, you know, you go to some event and some guy's got one of your airplanes. So I go up and talk to him and, you know, kind of find out what he likes about it. And it's a friendship that you make right there. You know, I listen to my dad when he answers the phones. You know, he's got guys that he talks to on the weekly basis just because they become really good friends. You know, they shoot the breeze. The guy's not calling to order anything. He's just calling to see how my dad's doing. And, you know, kind of the same thing out. My dad's, you know, calling people to see how they're doing. So it's been really, really good to see that.
Is there any particular challenges that, you know, running a company like this entails and people might not realize? I think we are, all of us, we're getting like so used to really good models, really. And also, you know, the industry is moving towards things being more ready to go and less work involved in getting a plane out in the air. So sometimes I see when something is not quite perfect, some people are very quick to complain and blame, not realizing that, you know, everybody makes mistakes and that these companies are actually very small profit margins. So I'm kind of curious from your side, what are those like challenges that people might not be aware of?
So honestly, I think the first challenge that a lot of people don't see right now, it's the prototyping. You know, trying to make a new airplane, because in China, you know, where most of these airplanes are made, they are also running a little bit leaner nowadays, you know, because again, talking with them, the economy over there is becoming more like ours, and their younger people aren't wanting to work in factories. So, like I say, a design element before we could get an ARF, I could send over the CAD drawings and have an ARF to me in 60 days, you know, 2 months, no problem. Now it's taking anywhere between 3 months to 6 months. We've had one take 9 months because again, they're not able to take their engineer that was scheduled to do, you know, the ARFs. Now he's working something else or he's on production. So that part makes it a bit difficult. So that was one of the first things. And I think you kind of see that, you know, Terry Wiles, anybody that follows Terry's, he's building these new caps with Extreme Flight. And they're doing a lot of their in-house prototyping in the USA. And I applaud them for that. I think it's incredible because, you know, you use the talent that Ben has. And, you know, Ben is an incredible person in Fusion. You know, anybody that's seen any of his projects, they're awesome. Well, he's kind of imposed that wisdom to Terry. And Terry's always been an incredible person in AutoCAD. So they're able to build these airplanes and prototype them here rather than, you know, go over to China and wait for them. You know, one of the things that me and Terry were talking about is, you know, he did that first 103 cap. Well, you know, you think about, okay, if we design one of these airplanes, say we'll use the cap, for instance, you airship it over. So it's $2,500 to airship that model over. And if you have to make a change like they're doing with this new version, you're talking another 3 months to get that airplane and another $2,500 to ship it over. So they're using their experience here to build it and kind of rapid, you know, make rapid changes to those prototypes. So, you know, that's why I think you're kind of seeing people go to that. And again, like I said, I applaud them for doing that because it's, you know, it kind of cuts down on that. And just to see the modeling aspect of Terry, right? It's crazy to go from a design, you know, from a drawing to an airplane in a week or 2 weeks. And now he's 3D printing plugs. And I think it's awesome. So after you get the prototype phase done, like you say, they're still hand-built model airplanes, right? The laser cutters, yeah, everything's going to be laser cut, but like bevels, hinges, that's all done by hand. So if you don't have a bevel that's actually absolutely perfect, it's because somebody was, you know, maybe they didn't sand it or they didn't look through it correctly. the covering, you know, if an edge comes up, again, these are put together by people. And just, you know, I always joke with people, I say, you know, you, everybody's had those days where you're going to work and you're just like, man, I don't want to be here today. Or you just feel off. And that happens. You know, so, and you kind of understand it from that aspect, and you can explain it to people. But one of the things that I've kind of said, and this is, again, it's no dig on anybody, but like when Horizon started up with the bind and flies, you know, it was great with the micros because it got people in at a low price point. But now that they've gone into further, you know, they've gone into bigger models, and then you get the people that are doing P&P models, you've taken some of the modeling aspect out of it. You know, people that don't know how to, you know, understand what geometry actually looks like and how to set up endpoints. You know, you don't put a two inch servo arm on something that's 3/4 inch, you know, on the control horn, because you're going to flutter it off. But people don't see that because a lot of that's been done before. So trying to keep people abreast of like, okay, this is still how you model, right? You still might have to sand something. You still might have to put a spacer in here, there. You might have to do a little bit of those types of things can get frustrating because, again, you see people, you know, we're trying to put the best product out that we can. But again, you know, when you're making, you know, 200 to 300 models at a time, you might have something that slips, you know, something that slips through, and I'm not asking people, you know, that they should have to redesign what the airplane's doing, but understand that there's going to be little things here or there. If it's missing a control horn or if it's missing a screw in there, that's parts, and we do everything we can to get it out to them without any issues. But in the end, it's still, you know, they're still handmade.
Yeah, and just to be clear, everything I've seen from AJ Aircraft, quality has been great. I haven't seen many complaints, actually. I think there's like a common theme across any of these brands. All of them run into the same interesting type of problems. I think the quality is actually really high, but again, like sometimes something slips and you get, rather than 100% perfect, it's like 99.9 perfect.
Yeah, well, and that's what, you know, me and a buddy of mine, Darren, we always joke about, you know, because honestly, the 95% of the people out there in the modeling world can't build as good as these ARF, you know, these ARF companies can now. You look back, you know, you look back at like when you were building a Cardin airplane, and for a 35%er, you were paying $1,300 for some foam and some balsa. And that's before you bought covering, before you bought paint, before you bought glue. You know, people kind of, they don't see that anymore. But again, you know, everything evolves and everything gets better. And that's, you know, that's what we try and do.
Yep. Any particular projects you're excited about with AJ Aircraft?
So actually, yeah, the one that we were out flying yesterday was the new 103-inch Extra 330SX. You know, I've never done an Extra, and I was kind of always, you got to do an Extra. Well, there just wasn't one that I liked. You know, everybody had done the 300, which to me is still the perfect iMac airplane. The SC, I wasn't a big fan of. I never loved the canopy way far back and the low wing. 260 was a very nice model, but again, you know, Extreme Flight, they are doing that one. And then I had kind of got wind of this, like this new project that Mr. Extra was doing. I was like, all right, like I kind of want to wait and see what this is. And then they announced it, that the SX, and I was like, okay. And I started looking at it, and it's a lot like an Extra 260. You know, they moved the pilot further forward. The wing isn't as low as some of their other models. So once I saw that, I said, okay, this is the one I want to do. And we had to figure out how to go to market, you know, as quick as we could. So I, you know, got on the phone with the factory and said, okay, this is what I want to do. I need to do this ASAP, right? We need to be able to come to the market as quick as we could. And I, you know, thankfully had some really good buddies. I was able to get some really good 3 views, you know, and then I started working kind of what I normally do to an airplane with my airfoils, with wing positions. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, talking to customers or people that don't see it is like a low wing airplane, right? It looks good on the ground. It works at full scale. You know, you talk to full scale pilots, it's because you can visually see everything. You know, a full scale Extra with the mid wing, they said it's the worst airplane ever to fly because the wing is at your shoulder. So you can't even see where you're taxiing. So that makes sense. But this SX, they moved it up a little bit. And when I was getting to it, the low wing, well, the low wing's great, except the Harriers don't end up being the same upright and inverted. Because when you're inverted, now you have a high wing airplane. And when you're upright, you have a low wing airplane. So they don't feel similar. So this Extra, when they moved it up, I was able to move it up a little bit more and keep it scale. And then, you know, it's just the normal stuff, right? It's making the tail big enough. And I ended up changing the airfoils quite a bit on this airplane. I wanted to test some stuff. I thickened up the rudder to try and help with some of the, I would say a lot of ARFs out there, like a lot of people let the factory kind of come up with the rudder airfoil because it's just whatever it needs to fit into the turtle deck. But a lot of them had a really sharp rudder off the center, and then they kind of died out as you got further out. So I changed the airfoil up on this one, and I found it's been very linear. And then the same thing on the wing airfoil. I moved the high point further forward because one of the things our airplanes have always done is they've been very, very stable at all airspeeds, but they never had the pitch authority. And what that was is a lot of that was my airfoil. It was because my high point I had moved further back because I wanted the wing to stall a lot slower. Well, when the wing stalls slower, you lose that inertia, right? You see these airplanes that are going wide open and they're tumbling really fast. It's because the airfoil, they break hard really loose. All that inertia is still built into the airplane. So, you know, I started doing a little bit of, you know, reconfiguring there. And I've been really excited about this airplane. They're in build right now. I'm really excited to get them out. We got, you know, a smaller version coming. It's just kind of brought a breath of fresh air into what we're doing. You know, you never want to say that things get kind of stagnant, but you know, you always are trying to evolve your company. You know, we're starting to do some PMP stuff. We have the 51 slicks coming in PMP. We got 61 slicks coming in PMP. And then, I actually haven't talked about it much at all, but I'll, you know, share it out here is we're doing a 61 inch Raven. The 61 inch Raven, it's going to have double tapered wings and straight leaning edge wings. We're going to do the PMP version of that. They're also in build. You know, just trying to continually improve our product. We've been very fortunate to work with Steve Johnson, who's done a lot of our new color schemes. So we're trying to keep things, you know, evolving even to that, right? Because what we had talked about before with people, you know, you can buy an airplane that you just like the looks of because you know you're going to get a good model. So, you know, you have to make sure you have good color schemes. You know, even that right there goes back to the dealing with the factory, right? If you have a lot of color schemes that have pointy ends that go into the wind, you know, trying to make sure that they know, like, you got to make sure the covering's down really good at right there, because if not, the first flight, they're going to blow off. And you have a customer complaining that his covering blew off. So, yeah. But, you know, it's just been really exciting. You know, getting, like I say, getting to spend time with my family and go to these events. You know, Joan All has always been it's always been a huge thing for us. You know, my mom, my dad go, I'm there working the booth, and we have all of our team guys now. And you kind of see a little bit of a dynamic shift, right? I was always the guy, like, I want to be at the flying field, or I want to be on the flight line flying the airplanes. And now I kind of enjoy sitting back and, you know, letting the younger kids go out and fly and really ring the stuff out and just take it all in, right? Kind of go from being their age and wanting to go out, but now knowing the whole experience and what it takes from taking that model from AutoCAD to the final production and you know, and knowing all those bits and pieces. Cause when I was younger, I didn't care, you know, what size wing tube we used, where we needed to double up, you know, formers. And now those are the things that I'm looking at, you know, watching people kind of fly the airplanes and see how they're doing. So that's one of the cool things that I really enjoy about the company.
Do you still enjoy 3D freestyle?
Yeah,
type thing.
I do. I go out and have fun with it. It's just one of those things that, like, it's something I like to do and don't really practice it, but go out and have fun. You know, when I kind of need a break, I always tell people, like, you know, pattern is kind of like the job of everything. You know, whether it's iMac or pattern. But when it's like the free time, that's when the freestyle airplanes come out. And a lot of times, honestly, it's my little 60-inch airplanes. I can fly in my backyard. I have a pretty big field that my house backs up to. So I can just take those out, go throw them around for a little bit, kind of let off some steam. Or honestly, one of the other things that I enjoy is helicopters. Same kind of thing.
You know, oh, really?
Yeah, Spencer Nordquist, he's an incredible helicopter pilot. Same thing, right? You don't really have it's hard to say, but you don't really have an expectation to live up to when you're flying them. You're just going out and you're having fun. You're doing it for yourself. So yeah, I have my little Mikado 550 SX that I fly in the backyard, and same deal. It's almost a decompression for me to do it. So yeah, no, I still love doing it. But what I really enjoy now is kind of getting the feedback from our team pilots. Hey, this is what we're doing. Are you feeling this thing? You know, we got a lot of really good young pilots that are able to throw down way better than I can ever. So I'm kind of just out there doing my thing and watching these guys going, I don't know how they do that, but it's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting how much more aggressive things have gotten over time with 3D and robotics.
Well, and people don't realize what that takes to design an airplane like that, right? Like, you know, having wings that have become so small because you need to be able to go from very fast to, you know, sub-stalled in a hurry. And it's definitely been an evolution. You know, Jace has been, you know, the kind of the pioneer when it comes to that. And in getting to watch him, you know, I don't think people respect and understand. You can watch it on videos, but when you see it in person every single time and how perfect it is all the time, like, I, you know, hats off to Jace. He's putting the work in. I mean, there's so many good pilots out there now that are doing it. Jace and Santiago, you know, the Walkers. I mean, it's the list goes on. You know, you watch Brian McFly, you know, you just had Brian on. And his ability to whoop my butt in the sequence portion and then go throw down an IMAX or then go throw down a freestyle is just incredible to me. So I'm, you know, the ability that they have and, you know, the wherewithal to do all that is just, it's awesome to watch. I mean, that's why one of the things I love to judge freestyle at the shootout is to kind of see the different styles of it for sure.
Any plans for 2024? Sounds like you probably will making it to the shootout.
Yeah, so we got our team trials for F3A, so that kind of takes part at our U.S. Nationals. So the top three guys at our U.S. Nationals will be on the team for 2025, which is actually going to be in Muncie. So you're gonna have a lot of guys going for it because it's going to be in the States. So we have that. We have Joan All, of course. We'll be at Joan All. My year's gonna change a little bit because I have a little one on the way.
Congrats!
Thank you. I'm super pumped. The end of June, we have our little baby boy being born. So then end of July, we have our nationals, and then in October, we have the shootout. Those are kind of the big things, and I'm sure, you know, kind of sprinkled in some local events and some local fun flies. Like we kind of hit on. I worked with Alex Drelling over at Cam Aero, and we have a new extra that mine's almost done. I test flew the one that he's got, and I'm pretty excited about that. So, you know, it's always fun to switch gears, going from, you know, pattern airplanes to IMAC airplanes and back and forth. And, you know, you always joke and say, oh, big airplanes got to have a trailer and you got to have this. But once you get done flying them, you're like, that, you know, that was a lot of fun. And you know, I was actually just talking to Garen O'Bruckman yesterday, and we were kind of joking about how we just really like flying against each other because my relationship with him is very similar to how mine and Leesburg was. We were always rooting for each other. You know, if he beat me and he had a good flight, like I was just as happy and if I were to have a good flight and, you know, and he was happy for me. So that part's fun. And the same thing with Brian Mack, you know, Brian and Ernie, you know, we go back and forth and banter while we're at the contest, but it's all in fun. And again, you know, it probably comes back to that part we talked about where, you know, it's a different group of people that you get to see every 2 years, you know, out in the desert. And it's just a lot of fun going to these events. And I was kind of joke about it, but kind of reliving my youth through it. Because again, I, you know, my first shootout was in 2004. So this is the 20th, you know, the 20 years since the first one. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I don't want to take much more of your time. I think I have one more question for you. And it's if you have any advice for people, you know, trying to take their RC journey to the next level, whether it's in robotics or something else. I know a lot of people look up to you in the hobby and especially, you know, robotic pilots. Mm-hmm. So,
man, I think the main thing, you know, like we kind of hit on first is to have fun with it, right? It's having fun is critical because that kind of drives everything. That drives you to want to go out to the flying field and go practice. Giving back to the hobby, you know, I think that's a critical thing that we have to make sure that we do. But when it comes to elevating your model airplane flying, you know, whether it's, you know, 3D or, you know, pattern, it is going with the mindset, you know, going with the, I'm practicing how I'm going to compete, you know, whether it's, you want to put a good freestyle routine together, don't do something just because it's a little bit easier, you know, put the work in. And you'll be rewarded with that, you know, with that hard work. And that's honestly the way that I feel like I've kind of gotten to where I am is just, I've worked hard, you know, kind of put my nose down and kept going because I know wasn't something that I wanted to hear. But again, it kind of all stems from, you know, working hard and having fun with it. You know, if I, if I'm not having fun, then I'm not going to want to go out to the flying field. I'm not going to want to focus. And, you know, if I can go out there and, you know, Paige, we always joke about, we always say, you know, I'm usually smiling the most after a day at the flying field, because that's just, you know, that's what I enjoy to do. And you know, you can go out and do any of that stuff, and if it puts a smile on your face, then you're just going to enjoy it that much more. So that's kind of what I would tell people is, you know, really, really have fun with it, but put the effort in, work hard, and it'll come. You know, for me, I flew F3A, you know, I won two national championships in advanced and masters. And then it took me eight years to win my first F3A worlds, or I'm sorry, my first F3A national championships in the US. And it just took a lot of hard work, right? It took a lot of willpower to continue to go to the flying field. Don't get me wrong. There's been plenty of those moments where you're like, man, I just don't know that I want to do this anymore. But you know, usually if you go to sleep and you wake up the next day and you go, okay, yep, nope, that was just me having a rough day, and you just go back out and do it. So that's my piece of advice.
I feel like many times some people don't realize all the work that comes behind it. Like,
oh, yeah.
When you see people with a lot of really good results, a lot of talent like you, like Jace, yeah, for sure, they have like a lot of talent, but there's a lot of training behind the scenes that people don't realize.
Yeah, I think I've seen something, you know, going through the internet, and it's like the 1% that people see, that, you know, they only think it's the 1%. It's the 99% that you've done where, you know, behind closed doors where nobody has seen.
Yep.
And it's very true. You know, people that put the work in are usually they always joke and say, you know, the luckiest people are the ones that work the hardest. And it's very true, because, you know, they've put the effort in. They know their, you know, they know their sport. I mean, you know, somebody I look up to huge is Kobe Bryant. You know, they talk mm-hmm. about, you know, the Mamba mentality, and you listen to him in high school, you know, the stuff that he did to get to the level that he was at. And, you know, you can say that he was a gifted player, but without the drive to get there, he wasn't that person. So I think, you know, I think that's
was obsessed to get to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And, yeah. and you have to be there to get to that level. You do have to be obsessed. And, you know, I've just been very fortunate to have a lot of really good people kind of in my court that allows me to, when my obsession gets a little crazy, you know, they're like, okay, you know, maybe reel it back a little bit, or you got another couple weeks of this crazy obsession, and then after that we're gonna shut it down for a little bit. So, but cool. You know, it's good stuff. Like I said, you know, even just, you know, look at this industry. It's allowed me to come on a podcast like this, and, you know, just share what I've done. So I'm super thankful for all of it.
Well, I think this was really fun, Andrew. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I know that people would really enjoy hearing you talk about all of this.
No, thank you again for inviting me on. I'm super excited to get to share a little bit of what I get to do.
Awesome. All right. See you later, Andrew.
All right. Sounds good. Take it easy.